In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Howard Gardner. He is a professor of cognition and education and adjunct professor of psychology at Harvard. In addition, he's also adjunct professor of neurology at the Boston University School of Medicine. He's co-director of Harvard Project Zero. He has received many honors, including a MacArthur Prize Fellowship. He's a man who has done a lot to encourage people to think about intelligence in a different sort of way. That is, that instead of seeing the mind as having just finite qualities of something called intelligence, he rephrased the concept of intelligence, defining it as a person's ability to solve problems and create useful products. So he opened the door to this idea that people don't have just one kind of intelligence, but many kind of intelligences. This morning, we'll be talking about a recent book that he has written. It's now out in paper, published by Penguin, that looks at the issue of school curriculum, what education should be about, what educated people should know. And this does indeed take into account some of his other thinking about intelligence. This book is titled The Disciplined Mind, the subtitle Beyond Facts and Standardized Tests, the K-12 Education That Every Child Deserves. And it is published by Penguin. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, certainly your questions and comments are welcome. All you need to do is pick up the telephone, and you can join our conversation. And the one thing that we just ask of callers is that people try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many different people as possible. But certainly anybody's welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Gardner, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. It seems that when we talk about reform, school reform, and certainly we in this country, we've been talking about a lot for a good 20 years now, most of the conversation seems to focus on what we might call infrastructure and not very much on curriculum. But it is that curriculum that you're focusing on in the Disciplined Mind. And I wonder, in fact, whether you think we've paid too much attention to one and not enough attention to the other.
Certainly, I understand the reasons why there's a lot of concern with charters and vouchers and general funding patterns, and I have those concerns myself. But at the end of the day, no matter how much money we spend on school, if we don't ask fundamentally what it is that we want youngsters to understand and be able to do at the end of the day, then we're not really grappling with the fundamental questions. And I have frankly been mystified why there's so little talk about what we really want kids to be able to understand when they finish school. So in The Disciplined Mind, I stuck my neck very far out, and I argued that basically school should do two things academically. The first thing, which I think is uncontroversial, is to help kids with the basic literacies, reading, writing, calculation. And if that goes well, and it doesn't always go well, that should be done certainly by the middle grades. Kids ought to be able to read and write and calculate with some proficiency by the time they're pre-adolescence. But then it seems to me that the major reason for continuing education through to college is to help kids think in terms of the major disciplines. And the disciplines that I identify in the book are history, science, mathematics, and at least one art form. And being able to think of the discipline has a very particular meaning. It just doesn't mean knowing a lot of facts or a lot of definitions. It means actually, in the case of science, understanding what science is trying to do, that science is trying to come up with a model of the world, that model has to be in accord with the data that we collect, and if the data aren't consistent with the model, we have to revise the model or think through our experiments. In the case of history, it's understanding that things happen in the past, but it's not easy to figure out exactly what happened. They're conflicting testimony. There often are very fragmented kinds of records from which we have to make sense. And moreover, our actual understanding of things in the past changes as the present changes. We don't think about the French Revolution or the American Revolution in the year 2001 the way they thought about it 100 or 200 years ago. And the sad news is that even kids who get good grades in so-called good schools often lack the disciplinary understanding. They can do well on a standardized test. They can perhaps even win a lot of money on a nighttime TV show. But if you actually say, look, this is what was discovered yesterday in a science lab, or this is what a recent history book claims, what do you think of it? What kind of sense would you make of it? What questions would you ask? How would you go about doing this if you were responsible? The kids are often clueless. And that raises the very profound question, are we wasting our money by sending kids to school once they've mastered the basic literacies?
Well, that, I guess what it comes down to, and this is such a big question, I'm sure one could talk about it for a long time, but I guess what it comes down to is, what is education? And the fact that we hope that education is something that happens in school, if we're lucky it does, but it's not necessarily the case that education is something that, that happens in school.
Yeah, I think that's well put. Certainly nobody should argue that education takes place only in school. Both education and miseducation take place on the streets and the media and, you know, by personal reflection. But we are talking about the value added, so to speak, that school can provide. And I actually think, going back to your opening comments, David, that one of the reasons there isn't much talking about the stuff of school is because if we actually talked about it, we would find that we don't agree. And that's why at the end of The Disciplined Mind, I put forth a proposal, which I call, kind of with a smile on my face, a policymaker's proposal. And that is, in a country as complex as the United States, it probably doesn't make sense to push for one best system. We ought to have at least a half a dozen curricular options which people can choose. They ought to be available all over the country, so if you move from Urbana to Spokane or to Bangor, you could have the same set of options. And each of those options ought to have a published curriculum and a published set of assessments, so you know if you go to an E.D. Hirsch school or a Ted Sizer school or a progressive school or a traditional school or a technology-centered school, what it is that you'll be able to understand at the end of the day. I keep using the word understanding because to me what's so depressing about most of the standardized testing that's going on all around the country now is it stops well short of understanding. What it really says is, you know, have you read a textbook and can you spit back what's in a text? And of course, you might understand perfectly well, but you might just have a good memory. Yet once you go out into the world, a good memory isn't going to do it. You're going to face new problems, new issues, new challenges, new puzzles. And if you can't mobilize the ways of thinking that you developed in school and outside of school to handle those new challenges, then basically your education's been wasted.
Well, it realizes in fact that maybe I'm asking the same question again, but it, as it so happens, I've talked with both of those guys that you mentioned and a lot of other people over the years about this very subject, and there seems to be some disagreement about just exactly what it means to be an educated person.
Well, absolutely, and I think those debates are public and important, and one reason for proposing a set of pathways is I have no particular interest in imposing my so-called understanding curriculum on individuals who have a very different kind of view of what learning and education should be about. That's partly what underlies charters and vouchers nowadays, is the notion of choice, except I don't think it makes sense to have 10,000 or 100,000 choices. I think that's just insane. That's why I'm pushing for a more circumscribed set of choices. But let me talk a bit about the differences between Hirsch and myself, because one of the things I discovered when I published The Disciplined Mind was that almost everybody who had an opinion about this seemed to think that Hirsch's point of view was correct. And since I didn't, that was kind of a shock to me. And Hirsch's view, and I want not to caricature it, is that in order to be part of the community in America at all, in order to be part of the conversation, you need to know certain things which we could call facts and definitions. And since we don't have a national curriculum, what Hirsch has done is to lay out the information which he thinks kids should get in first grade, second grade, third grade, and so on. And certainly, I am all in favor of people being culturally literate. I love people who, you know who Shakespeare is and who can name the planets and things like that. The problem with Hirsch's proposal, paradoxically, is that it's not ambitious enough. And that is that you could know all the facts in the world, But if you can't fit them together in some kind of a meaningful framework, if you don't understand the relationship, say, between the names of the planets and where they're located and how the solar system works and why we are where we are and what we can see and what we can't see and what the gravitational pulls are, so on, if you can't put it all together into some kind of a coherent story, the fact that you know about Neptune and Pluto, it doesn't get you very far. And so what I argue in the disciplined mind, and this is an iconoclastic argument, is it's much more important to go into a limited number of topics deeply so that you really know what it means to think about something scientifically than just to sort of skim the top, which is what I think the E.D. Hirsch curriculum ends up doing. That is, you end up knowing lots and lots of information, but it doesn't cohere. It's sort of like having the ornaments for a Christmas tree without the Christmas tree itself. My argument is once you, for example, have understood a few poems very well because you've gone into them very deeply, you then can read other poems with that same degree of depth. Indeed, you would be frustrated if you simply read a poem very quickly. But if you've read 100 poems a year very quickly, if you've taken a world history course where you go from Plato to NATO in 36 weeks, the most you can do is just remember a few isolated things, and as memory fades, you even forget that. So it's a question, really, of do you try in school to stuff a lot of information into kids, or do you try to give them a few fundamental structures of thinking which they can then put their own ornaments on in the future. Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of, and I mean, I would bet that even people who listen regularly to NPR, which is not a random sample of the population, don't hear discussions of the question I raised very much. They kind of assume it's not problematic, or, yeah, if you get all the facts right, the disciplines will take care of themselves. And that's exactly what cognitive science has shown is wrong, is that you can have facts up the kazoo, but unless you have ways of thinking about them relating to one another, they don't adhere.
Yeah.
They don't cohere.
Yeah, and I think oddly enough, I find myself really torn between these two poles, and feel in a sense that you're both right. When I talked to Ed Hirsch a number of years ago, but I think one of the questions I posed to him was, what is it that keeps this from being kind of a trivial pursuit played at a very high level? And I don't think he gave me a very good answer. At the same time, I guess I would think having a broad base of knowledge is important. It gets more difficult all the time because there are more things to know.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, though, I think that you're absolutely right that one can't just stuff facts into young people, that what you're trying to do is teach them how to think and how to think about not just things they already know, but how to think about those things when they encounter them that they don't already know.
Here's something where I think probably the three people who were talking about Hirsch, Sizer, and I would agree, and that is probably the best way to pick up that general information is to read a lot.
Hmm.
And nowadays, in the days of the Internet and the web, we might say to read and surf a lot. And the young minds are wonderfully capable of doing that. The sad thing in America is not that people can't read, is that people don't read, and they particularly don't read books. I mean, those people who do read newspapers and magazines, which is fine, but it's a different experience from reading books where you have a chance to not only, in the case of fiction, create a great work of art, but in the case of nonfiction, to develop a sustained argument. And what we're all struggling for, in a sense, is how to get kids to want to read so they can have a well-furnished, well-stocked mind. Hirsch's way, and we've actually debated this several times on radio and in print, is to say to the teachers at each year, look, these are the things which we think the kids ought to know. And that's one way of doing it. And I certainly can't oppose it as being fundamentally misconceived. My way of doing it is to get kids really interested in stuff, because I think what in the end is determines who reads is who's motivated to read. And who's motivated to read is somebody who realizes that's the best way to find out about things you're interested in. You know, is to indulge your curiosity, and, you know, going to museums is another way, as I say, surfing the web, hanging around lots of interesting people. Reading isn't the only way of doing it, but over the last few thousand years, it's the best way. And what worries me about a Hirsch school and makes me more sympathetic to a Sizer or Gardner school is you might actually turn off a lot of kids because they would think, well, school is learning this many definitions each year. And much more seriously, and this here we get to the whole standardized test picture in the United States at this time, turn off the most promising people to go into teaching.
Mm.
People go into teaching because they're excited about learning and because they want to excite other kids. And if they live in a state, and now it's just every state in the union, where they're instead told, look, this is your marching orders, and if kids don't get up 3 points in next year's exam, standardized test, then, you know, the school will lose money or we'll close it down, that's not going to motivate the right kind of people to go into education. It's going to basically going to motivate mechanics to go in and say, oh, yes, well, you know, if we practice the test 3 more times, we'll get the scores up 3 points. Yeah. It's deeply anti-intellectual. And I was just listening, perhaps to the same newscast that you were broadcasting of our president asking kids, you know, do you watch more television or do you read more? Did you hear that?
Yeah.
He said, well, you know, you really ought to read more and not watch so much TV. And, of course, he's absolutely right. Alas, he's not the best spokesperson for that because whereas Mr. Clinton, like him or dislike him, was an omnivorous reader, George Bush is not. And so there's a certain inauthenticity in his calling for that. And we need to expect both our teachers and our leaders to walk the talk. I think teachers, and I try to do this myself as a teacher, who talk about what they're reading,
yes,
and not just reading, but meeting, talking, and so on, and make that part of education are giving a very important message. I've made it a practice ever since I began to teach of reading 2 newspapers every morning before I go to class. And the reason I do that is I want, whenever possible, to be able to draw on something that I've just learned about. And I want to say, you know, there was an article in the Globe today, there was an article in Times today, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, I want to engage the students in that, but I'm trying to give them a subliminal message as well, which is, namely, if you are an educated person, you ought to be knowing what's going on in the world today. I'll put in a plug for NPR, as you just heard. It's on with me all the time because it's another way that I keep up with what's going on. So that's where the motivation about becoming literate, really, that's where the rubber hits the road.
Yeah.
Because even if you've learned 5,000 facts, as Hirsch promises on the cover of one of his books, if the day after school ends, nobody's telling you what to learn, and you go back to being a couch potato or worse, then your education's been wasted.
I need to, pardon me for interrupting you here, but I have a little weather information I need to pass on to people.
And sounds like it's kind of bad weather.
It is. And then we have a caller I want to get to as well. Just real quick here, the National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Cumberland County in east central Illinois that will be in effect until 12:15 central time. Just about 10 minutes ago, the National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe storm 10 miles southwest of Neoga, moving northeast at 45 miles per hour. The storm will be near Neoga to Toledo Greenup. It's capable of producing winds in excess of 60 miles an hour and some very heavy rain. So they suggest you take shelter and stay away from windows. And again, we'll keep you up today on what's going on with the weather, because we do expect that as this moves through our area, there probably will be a number of similar warnings. But this is severe thunderstorm warning, Cumberland County, until 12:15 central time. Our guest,
I was in Urbana in June of 1998, and you had the most awful thunderstorm at that time. We had to actually go into shelters.
That would be the time you'd expect it. Right now, this time of the year, it's a little bit unusual. Springtime, yeah, can be pretty volatile this part of the country. Our guest, by the way, Howard Gardner, he is Hobbs Professor of Cognition and Education and Adjunct Professor of Psychology at Harvard University. He's written a number of books, particularly dealing with the idea of multiple intelligences. So if you'd like to find out more about that, you can seek out his books. And then this one here we're talking about this morning is titled The Disciplined Mind, and it is published by Penguin in paperback, just came out last August. So it's been out for a while and certainly should be in the bookstore or in the library. And we have a caller here to talk with, and it looks like we could get some others. We'll start out here with someone in Champaign, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Just a quick comment. I expect I probably agree with your host on most things, because I keep preaching that in grade school, children need to learn that they are valuable and competent. After that, it's good if they learn how to read. But a comment about the current political climate, and education is a very, very political animal and always has been, and that is, I don't understand how you propose to test what you actually want to teach, which is how to think. I'll just hang up and listen to that. But the reason that Hirsch's viewpoint is so popular these days is you can test it. And I don't understand how you can test whether or not, for example, children feel that they're competent.
Yeah, that, I think it's an excellent question. Professor Gardner, you want to talk about that?
Okay, well, I certainly believe that you can assess whether kids have disciplinary understanding, and that's what I argue for in the disciplined mind. And the way to do that, as I mentioned very briefly, is to give them something new, something which they couldn't possibly have studied about in school, and say, try to make sense of this particular phenomenon. So, you know, we read in the paper last week that scientists claim that they've stopped light. The light is no longer moving 186,000 miles a second. What does that mean? If it's true, what implications does it have? If you didn't know, how would you find out? You read in the paper today that Mr. Sharon in Israel is trying to form a unity government, and he's actually asked Barack to become Secretary of Defense. Can you do this kind of thing? Does it work? Could it happen in the United States? These are things where you have to make sense of new kinds of information. If you have some understanding of science in the one in the first case, if you have some understanding of government and political science in the second case, you can begin to make sense of that, or you can at least talk about what questions you would ask to make sense. So I don't think there's any particular problem in assessing whether students are understanding or not. The caller, if I understood him correctly, was asking about assessing whether kids are competent. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems to me there's no point in assessing that separately. You indicate what you want kids to be able to understand and be able to do, and if they're doing it, then you let them know they're doing it, and if not, you try to help them. And I don't think anybody should ever end up feeling incompetent as long as they're working hard and trying to make use of the feedback they get. I think the problem often happens when kids are not motivated to work well, or they get very discouraged because they don't get good, helpful kind of feedback. But to my mind, that's a challenge to teachers. I always say the smarter the teachers are, the smarter the kids will get. If you have teachers who care about kids being motivated, if you give them useful feedback, if they provide support when needed, but also let the kids be independent when needed, then you will likely have kids who do feel competent and confident. If, on the other hand, you don't challenge them very much, kids know when they're not being challenged, they're not foolish, or if you give them things which they can't possibly handle on their own, you don't give them any help, then the kids are going to be defeated. So I guess the short answer to the question is competence isn't something you test for, it's something you attempt to achieve by the way you teach kids and by the messages you give them when they're doing well and when they're not doing well.
Well, I guess what I heard the caller to be getting at was this issue that nowadays the big buzzword in education is accountability, and it seems that the only way that we really have to establish student performance is standardized testing. I mean, the president's been talking about that recently. There, in many states, including this one and our neighboring state of Indiana, there are these tests that students take periodically to establish how they're doing in regards to their peers and whether they're performing up to the standards that we have. And it seems that that you can't really get at the kinds of things that you're interested in with a standardized test.
I don't agree with that at all. Standardized has two meanings. One meaning, which I'm totally in favor of, is that you can compare kids across jurisdictions, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The other one is short answer multiple choice. It's there where I go ballistic. Because whether it's advanced placement tests or international baccalaureate tests or the kinds of tests that are used at any college or university where I respect, we do get it understanding. We don't get it lowest common denominator kinds of thinking. So the fact that we are in many states, not all, embracing what I'll call Nudnik kinds of tests, basic information without any thinking involved, is a problem with the people who make up the tests. It's not a problem with the technology. We can perfectly well assess much more subtle forms of thinking. Certainly, I do it at my university, and many other people do it in good public and private schools all over the country. I think it's a current certain mental attitude we have now that if you can't ask for four multiple choices, the fourth one being none of the above, then it's not a good test. And that to me is just an insipid way of thinking, which, by the way, is not observed anywhere else in the world to anywhere near the extent that it is here. Let me make two other points about standardized testing in the first sense, namely testing that you could compare, where you could compare kids with other kinds of kids. I would wholeheartedly endorse any place which did standardized testing, which had the following two features. The first feature is that since we're asking about understanding And since nobody can understand everything, you give kids some choices. So if they can't answer the question about what's going on in Israel today, then they also have a chance of making sense of what's of Bush's efforts at bipartisanship in Washington today, or what's happening in the European Union now, because they all get a political scientific thinking, and I don't care whether the people happen to have the facts about Israel. To me, that's irrelevant. So number one, give students some choices. Number two, change the form of the test every year, because we're undergoing now a complete exercise in self-delusion in this country now. Namely, we put a certain test into place, and every year the teachers train the kids for the test, and because the kids can, and the teachers both get better trained, and then the scores go up. But then if you introduce a different test, which is trying to get the same thing, the scores get right back down again, because the kids haven't really understood deeply or learned deeply. They've become trained SEALs to handle a certain kind of test. There are very few of any jurisdictions which would dare to do that, because everybody knows there's a kind of a giant charade going on where we're pretending that things get better by not really taking the risk of giving a new kind of instrument. So you can see this touches quite a strong nerve in me. And I think that, you know, 10 or 15 years from now, after we've gone through this whole thing, we'll say, gee, we've really been assessing some really pretty silly things, and we haven't really have kids who understand anything that counts.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller on a cell phone. They'll be next here, line number four. Hello.
Yes, I'm very interested in what you have to say. I think you have an extremely number of valid points. I was teaching a liberal arts class in a community college, and I asked a student what he thought about a particular issue, and he says, I don't know. And I said, well, I'm not asking you to know about it. I said, I'm asking you to think about it. And he sat there for a while, and he says, you know, nobody in high school asked me to think. And he wasn't being funny about it. He was being dead serious. And I think that's the critical point, is that you, of course, you have to know facts, but you have to be able to connect these facts with something meaningful in your life. And not only do we do it with all sorts of different fields of study, but we have to be able to connect it with our own personal lives and how it makes any difference. And I also wanted to ask you another question, which is in the same realm, but what do you think of emotional intelligence, and shouldn't we be, trying to improve people's emotional intelligence or empathy for others and so on in the teaching process? And I'll let you go. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call.
Okay. Well, I think that's a very poignant anecdote where the student essentially said, you know, thinking that that's not what school's been about so far. It's very sad. It's a very telling. It's a poignant anecdote. As for emotional intelligence, as most listeners will know, that's a concept developed by a man named Dan Goleman, who was a science writer for the New York Times, and he wrote a very popular book with that title, which has since prompted a lot of activity both in education and in business. And I'm quite sympathetic with Dan Goleman's notion of emotional intelligence. It actually relates to what I call the personal intelligence, as understanding of other people, what I call interpersonal intelligence, and understanding of yourself, which I call intrapersonal intelligence. And that's roughly speaking what Goleman is trying to achieve. And there's no question that that's a different set of skills than being able to do well in a language test or a mathematical test. The question is, what should we do to encourage the development of emotional intelligence if we think it's important? And my own feeling here is that people are likely to become emotionally intelligent if they are surrounded by people who have some emotional intelligence, and that they themselves are expected to be emotionally intelligent. So to be a bit more specific, if you have parents and teachers and peers who are thoughtful about other people and who are also reflective about themselves, and if when you're not being thoughtful, you're called on it, and if you're being foolish in your own life decisions, people say, you know, I don't really understand why you did that, that's likely to make you more emotionally intelligent. Many schools, this is sort of the American way, say, well, there's such a thing as emotional intelligence. Let's create a curriculum and let's measure it. And I have nothing against that in principle, but I'd bet my reputation that people are much more likely to become emotionally intelligent if they have contact with adults who are than if they take a course and a test on it. I mean, in China, everybody memorized Chairman Mao's book of How to Be a Moral Person, and then when the Cultural Revolution came about, they turned in their parents and their teachers, and they were killed. It wasn't that they hadn't memorized the things well, it was that they hadn't seen models of how to be civil human beings around them. So I'm a big believer in the importance of modeling when it comes to having a certain kind of human being.
All right. I appreciate the caller's question. Let's go to line number two for someone else. This is Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to give you a quotation that's inside a logic textbook that I happen to have, and then I have a question. The quotation goes, "Oh, send him somewhere where they will teach him to think for himself." Mrs. Shelley answered, "Teach him to think for himself? Oh, my God, teach him rather to think like other people." And that's from Matthew Arnold, Essays in Criticism. Yeah, it seems to me there's people don't acknowledge just how big a faction there is out there who's adamantly against critical thinking, logical thinking.
Actually, a citizen of Illinois named Phyllis Schlafly, whom you may know of the Ego Forum, once said, "I'm not against thinking; I'm just against critical thinking." And that's a variation on the same theme. But excuse me, go ahead.
Oh, that was good. They don't want their kids to gain any kind of ability to guard against self-deception, for example. Like you were talking earlier, a lot of this has found its way into schools. When you were talking about having to think and not just memorize, I think a lot of people get out of science or get turned off by science because their first exposure is biology, which is a lot of, you know, learning terms and all that. But anyway, I was just trying to get at this notion that those with influence don't want people reinventing the system. They look at it as kind of a way to reward the best jobs, and as long as their kids are doing well, the heck with the rest of the world, you know. They don't want anybody pointing out the flaws in society. But I was going to ask you about, I don't hear enough about that. And I was going to ask you, though, whenever Bush gets on the television, I tend to tune out kind of unconsciously or without any control. But I did hear that in Texas, where they were getting into this heavy testing, where a lot of teachers were complaining that students weren't learning, they were just being taught to test. He had this rather peculiar approach, which I haven't heard a thing of since then, but I'm kind of ambivalent as to whether it's good or bad, and that's because what he did was for a high school, he'd have scores for different groups within the high school. Like he'd have a score for the blacks in the
right.
High school, Hispanics in the high school. Oh, you know about this?
It's called disaggregating scores. Yeah.
Yeah, and then he would make the tag the entire high school, label the entire high school according to the lowest group grade, you know, as to whether it was adequate or superior or whatever. It wasn't that, you know, the school would put out a marquee saying that blacks didn't do too well in this school and therefore we're below par. The whole school would just be called below par, and no one, you know, and only the parents would know it was because of the blacks, I presume. But the one good thing about that, though, was that apparently if the people in the community wanted to bring their high school's reputation up, they would have to put a lot of resources into that particular group.
Right.
And so I was just wondering what you had to say about all that.
No, I think you've analyzed it correctly, and it's, in fact, one of the interesting paradoxes of the year 2001 is that left and right, except for the extremes, are in agreement that it's raising the performance of poor and minority, which basically in our country means black, Hispanics, and Native Americans. Raising their performance is the number one challenge to the school system. And it's quite remarkable that there's agreement about this. And I think, speaking with a candor that one often doesn't find even on NPR, a lot of the national testing is really designed as a pressure on the people who teach in those particular schools or in the schools which have a large number of poors and minorities to to improve their performance. And one can understand everybody's frustration if their scores continue to be low and kids are not ending up learning very much in school. What are the levers that we have to improve that those scores? So to this point, I think there's probably not very much disagreement except among people who are really ideological. However, you have to ask whether the cure is the right cure. And there are a couple of things to bear in mind about the Texas experience. First of all, it was really George Bush had nothing to do with it. It goes all the way back to Ross Perot in 1983 and 1984. The old timers remember he said, if you don't pass, you don't play football. And there's an educational reform that's been in place in Texas for the last 20 years. And Bush didn't stop it, but he certainly didn't invent it. That's the first point. The second point, and there was a big flurry of excitement about this during the summer in the campaign, is while it's true that scores of blacks and minorities have gone up in Texas, and in Texas as a whole the scores have gone up, that's on the Texas assessment system, which is called the TAS system. But when you look at the other scores, and particularly the NAEP, which is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the scores haven't gone up. And that's exactly what I was referring to earlier when I said kids are being trained on one particular kind of test really rather than developing skills, which presumably should show up in any kind of a test. The third point, and here there's a lot of controversy, and I'm going to Houston next week to try to find out a bit more about this, is to what extent the scores are going up because kids are either dropping out of school or because kids with problems are not being allowed to take the test. Because you can certainly raise scores if you force a lot of kids to drop out, and then you don't include people who have special ed and things like that. So it's a very, very complicated system. I don't for a minute question George W. Bush's motives in education. Indeed, I think he's more impressive on education than he is on any other issue. Nonetheless, part of my job as a scholar is not to take him at his word, but to raise some of the questions both about what happened in Texas and more generally whether the cure is worse than the disease. If you end up training kids on one kind of exam only and end up discouraging people who have more imagination from going into teaching because they don't want to be Ross Perot's hound dog.
Yeah, very good. Imagination, that's one of the keys. Thank you.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Howard Gardner. He's professor of cognition and education and adjunct professor of psychology at Harvard University. He's the author of a number of books that explore the idea of multiple intelligences. And his recent, fairly recent book here, published by Penguin in Paper last August, deals with school curriculum. It's titled The Disciplined Mind, and it's published, as I say, it's published by Penguin. And we do have about 10 minutes left. Someone wants to call in, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I would like to give you an opportunity to talk specifically about your approach that you outline in the book, one that, interestingly enough, I think initially traditionalists would applaud maybe until they actually start to hear you.
Keep my mouth shut. You're right. I deliberately embrace a very traditional curriculum, not just in terms of history, art, science, and math, but also because I say that these disciplines are developed to help people ask what I think are the most fundamental questions human beings ask: what is true and what's not true, what's beautiful and why do we value it, and what's not beautiful, what's good and what's evil. Those are really very, very fundamental questions. People have always asked them. People rely on their common sense. They rely on experience. But science and math and history and the arts are efforts over time that communities have developed to be able to allow us to think better about those things. We have a better sense of truth because of the disciplines than if we just relied on our common sense, which is so often common nonsense. Because true, beautiful, and good sound pretty esoteric, I use three very concrete examples in the book. I use the example of the theory of evolution, which is the closest thing we have to a scientific truth about where human beings come from. I use the music of Mozart because I think it's a wonderful example of something very beautiful human beings have produced. And then I use the Holocaust because it's a cardinal example of human evil in the past century. And I argue that if you go into deeply into those topics and you really begin to understand evolution or Holocaust or a work of Mozart's, that you not only know what it's like to understand something deeply, but you begin to develop those habits of mind which allow you to look at other scientific, other historical, other aesthetic objects in a way that goes beyond the superficial. And I say that if you spend time on these things, if you really probe them deeply, then you can make use of the fact that we have different kinds of intelligence, because you're then freed to present materials in lots of different ways, and let kids show you their understanding in lots of different ways. Because we feel so oppressed to cover so many things, we tend to present everything verbally, and we tend to test everything in words. And if people do well, we say they're smart, and we promote them. If they do badly, we pull our hair out and say, you know, you can't learn. But any topic of any significance can be presented in lots of different ways if you take time. And any topic where you want to probe somebody's understanding, there are lots of ways in which they can show what they understand, what it is they don't understand. We don't have to simply do it with a standardized kind of mentality. But because we feel so pressured to get through everything, we end up sort of settling for these shortcuts. My kids have studied in school a curriculum called Facing History in Ourselves. It's about the Holocaust and its relationship to more contemporary events in America. And it's a very powerful curriculum, and anybody who's studied it really is affected by it. But it's the first thing to go in any state where there's a mandated test, because you can't afford to spend 8 weeks on anything, because, you know, there are 500 topics that have to be covered that year. Interestingly, and really counterintuitively, when we compare American students in math and science to students in other countries, we find American kids do not do well. And when you then look at the curriculum, you find in those other countries they actually cover fewer topics, but they do it in more depth. And here's the amazing thing. The kids often will do better on topics that they haven't studied than American kids will do better on topics they have studied. Now, that sounds bizarre until you realize that studied in America means the teacher said a few words about it, it was on the this week's test, and then you went on to something else. Whereas in, let's say, Japan or Singapore or Finland or Hungary, places which do much better than we do, the kids have learned how to think mathematically. So even if they haven't run into a certain kind of problem before, they've got a pretty good sense of how you might approach it. Or even if they haven't learned about a certain kind of war before, because it wasn't covered in their curriculum, they've learned how to think about battles and think about military objectives and so on. So I think we're selling ourselves way short by this run as fast as you can over as much information as you can and see how much is left at the end of the year, rather than probing deeply into things that really matter, learning how to think about them profoundly, and then saying, how, now that I've understood something about this particular scientific phenomenon or this particular historical event or this particular poem, how can I make use of that thinking when I run into the next work of art or the next historical event or the next science? Mm. You can see I'm really trying to move mountains here, but one of the lectures you have, if you're a scholar writing about these things, is you don't have to let the latest meeting of the Illinois legislature dictate what you do. You can try to think about things in a broader way, as did Matthew Arnold, who was quoted by a listener a few minutes ago. He tried to think about education in a much broader way as well. And I guess in the disciplined mind, in one chapter I mentioned Matthew Arnold three times. He was a mid-19th century English poet and writer. And I said, I rather surprised Matthew Arnold finding himself quoted for the third time in this chapter, because he's not, even among the cultural literate, he's not known very well, but he had a lot of important things to say about education in a rather different time.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to try to squeeze one more person. We'll go here to St. Charles. So I have to ask you to be brief, but please go ahead.
Okay, a few years ago in a similar discussion about education, I heard two quotes. I remember the quotes, but not who made them. Maybe you know who made them, and maybe you could comment on them. One was, the closer you live to Canada, the better education you get. And the second one was that we know what to do about education in the school system, we just don't want to pay for it. Hang up and listen, all right?
Okay, I actually haven't heard either of those quotations before. It is true that the upper Midwest is stronger in education than the other parts of the country. I think it has to do with the populations that moved there in the 19th century and that valued education. But I don't know whether it's true about people who rim Canada and other parts of the world, like Eskimos, Alaskans, and so on. I don't really know about that. Obviously, amount of money spent in education has some relationship to quality. And anybody who doubts that, say, you know, drop your kid out of the private school he's going to and send him to a place in New Jersey where they pay a quarter as much, and you say, are you nuts? So in one sense, it's a no-brainer. But I don't try to advocate education, which I think will be more costly. I try to say we need to think very carefully about what our priorities are and whether at the end of the day we're doing a service both to kids and to the world in which they live to continue to teach in ways that we're doing now. And that's much more a question of will and the priorities than it is a question of money. I actually think that I could talk forever and not have much effect, but I think the technological revolution will have effect, and probably the major effect it will have, is we'll be able to individualize education as much as we want. We will be able to teach every kid stuff in ways which the kid finds understandable, and the kids will be able to show what they've understood. And anybody who says, I taught algebra one way and the kid didn't understand, therefore the kid is stupid, will be out of a job, because we'll be able to see every day via technology very individualized forms of education. My fear is that the technology, wonderful as it is, tends to be anti-depth. It doesn't particularly encourage going into things deeply. And that's where I think working with somebody who cares about something over a long period of time with other people who care about it, whether it's the theory of evolution or the French Revolution or photosynthesis or the music of Duke Ellington, that's really what excites you about the use of your mind. And what's really important is not what happens in school, but once you leave school. And I'm willing to bet on the disciplined mind in that context.
Well, we will have to leave it at that. There's much more to the argument than our guest makes. And again, I'll suggest if you're interested in reading more, you look for the book. It's titled The Disciplined Mind. It's published by Penguin and is available in paper. Our guest, Howard Gardner, teaches at Harvard University. Professor Gardner, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to talk with you, David, and your listeners.